Our guest this morning is writer and filmmaker Meera Bilbrough, who's just published a memoir about her time as a teen living in a tiny hippie community at Manoroa in remote Pelorus Sounds in the 1970s. Meera is based in Sydney but was born and educated in New Zealand, and it was anything but a conventional childhood. Age seven, she was sent to live with her formidable grandmother in Wellington, away from her parents and sibling. At 14, she was kicked out by her communist grandmother and turned to her father, whom she had up till then had very little to do with. He was living as a recluse in the Nelson-Marlborough area after his marriage failed. And after a time living in Canvastown and then in Nelson, she moved, Meera did, to the hippie community in the far reaches of the Marlborough Sounds with her father. Meera Bilbrough made a short film about this time in her life called Floodhouse. And how now the memoir, titled In the Time of the Manoroans, is published by Victoria University Press. Meera Bilbrough is with us from Sydney. Good morning and welcome.
Hi, Catherine. Great to be here.
It's such a personal story, but also a fascinating portrayal of a very unusual upbringing and a piece of New Zealand history that feels a little bit back in time right now. Has it always been a matter of time before you put this down on paper in a memoir?
I wouldn't say consciously, but I think that when I made the short feature film Floodhouse in 2003, I feel as if I kind of prized the lid open on, I don't know if it was Pandora's box, but I think the lid was off from then. And so there was perhaps a sense of something, you know, films are funny. There's only so much you can ever fit in a film. It's same with a memoir, but I think the process had begun. And it was another 15 years before I went back to that material, but I think it was lying in wait. Yes.
Well, suitable for a filmmaker. There are many photos. In fact, the imagery is a very powerful part of the book and the storytelling of the book. Some from when you were very young. And could you tell us a little of what those early years were like for you?
You mean the really sort of pre-seven?
Yeah.
Yeah, because the book has a kind of glancing structure where I sort of time travel a bit between periods. It's not a straight chronological download. So I did live with my parents till I was seven, and they were but peripatetic. They were kind of moving around and experimenting with who they were. I think they saw themselves as sort of early in the New Zealand context beatniks. I don't know if early is the word, because I don't know how many beatniks there ever were. And artists. So I was travelling with them, but their experiments, I think, were quite, once I entered school, those experiments were pretty embarrassing for me, you know, sort of really hardcore health food way, way before health food was sort of boutique and groovy, and just seemed patently indigestible and who would eat it. They were different. They were very, very flamboyantly, conspicuously different. And I think school can be a bit of an era of, you know, of you just want to be like everyone else. Especially I think maybe in a country school, where difference seems to show up even more sharply maybe than in an urban school. And they were quite tricky years, and their marriage was failing. So, I ended up being sent to live with my grandmother, which was her idea, and that was my mother's mother. Yeah, and was a saving grace.
What unfolds through this story, and you're in your 40s, I think, when you really, when you write of a time where you really begin to reflect perhaps on its impacts, but what unfolds are the complexities of damaged people, perhaps hurting people, and a young child perhaps not understanding some of her experiences, and particularly this is so with your mother. And when you reflect now on her experiences and the loss of a child and the impact that that appears to have had on her, do you understand much more now than you did as a child the disconnect between you and her?
Yes, I think there's a level at which it sort of primarily you can't understand it, you know, just some untouched primal place, and then there's the reflective level as you grow and you become potentially mother age. I mean, I haven't had children, but you even just sort of understand things physically, in your bones and in your body, and so yes, very much so. And we're close friends now. So, and I will just sort of, just to track back a bit, I think that term damaged people, it's sort of tricky because it puts people over there, you know, in a category. And I think we all have damage. And I'm not making excuses. I just kind of want to point that out.
No, that's a very fair point. That's a very fair point.
What? And I also, just a tiny bit, there's been some really sort of lovely coverage for the book, just even in its, you know, early week or so of being out. And I think sometimes it slightly gets overlooked too that my parents were artists, and so there's quite a lot of a sort of a very turbulent, sometimes damaging, but also very creative environment, and that's something that's come down to me and probably created the possibility of me being an artist.
I understand. That said, when you reflect now as a child, understanding why you were living with grandmother at seven, the thing about children sometimes, isn't it, is that sometimes life just is. And it's not until later that we do have, from an adult's perspective, we can go back and say, goodness, the impact of this must have been so profound. And what were your experiences of, as you say, you know, the separation in many ways from your parents and coming to live with your grandmother? Again, one senses a great love for her, and one senses a very complex woman with her own, a lot of her own stuff going on. But reading of your childhood experiences, it's hard not to feel some pain for you. But what were you feeling?
You know, I think in some ways, you know, when I think I was quite a sunny little girl, I can sort of sometimes I can see a photograph of me from that time, and I'm quite amazed by the sunniness that just sort of beams out. But I remember that feeling. I remember that person. And my grandmother's was just, it was a bit of a wonderland in that it was just so, she wasn't entirely middle class, but she sort of had the accoutrements of comfort, you know, carpet, tea towels, television, sparkles, my induction into sparkles, which she bought at the corner store. I mean, all these things to a seven-year-old. It's just so, I suppose I just felt really safe and full of delight. And she was someone who could create this sort of cozy cultural environment, and I loved it. So in that way, I really embraced it. It was a bit trickier with school, and I did really sort of miss my parents. I really pined for my dad. But it was another world away, and I was just very sort of quickly immersed in this very lively household that my grandmother had, because it also there was extended family. You know, there were her other daughters and my cousins and a cat, and it was urban. You know, it was in Kelburn and Upland Road. So I think I just got on. And I did. I also always really enjoyed learning. So there was all of that as well. You know, there was school.
there was a stimulating environment in that respect for an intelligent girl, and also one who, have you always been a tremendous observer? I mean, the detail of place, let alone of people, in the memoir is particularly striking. And were you at that young age a very close observer of people and of their interactions?
Well, I do. My father did say to me a number of years ago, you always knew when you were a tiny child, just sort of exactly where you could go with people, with individuals. And I don't think he meant it in the sense of how far you could go in terms of disobedience and discipline. I think he was talking about some other kind of just a social capacity or a connection. So maybe that's always been part of my character. I do remember that my mother was quite unnerved when I was a tiny child by my watching. And of course, a young child watches for to learn, you know. And I was often cast in the role of watcher, I think, because they were so tumultuous. And maybe it was just part of my temperament. I think it is part of my temperament. And I find that I'm a teacher now. So I do a lot of sort of putting out, you know, and expressing, and I really adore that. But I need that really sort of quiet time of observation just to reboot and rekindle. And if I don't have it, I feel very drained. So I think it's a great pleasure to me. It's just always been a source of pleasure, you know.
There is one observation in the book that one cannot go past, and I'm interested into how you have thought about this and processed this. And it goes to when your grandmother would confide that her own mother picked her up once as a child and said, "I will never love you." And that rejection became something that appears to have rippled through the generations. Now, I'm hearing you, it's wonderful to hear you saying that you're friends with your mother now over the many complex sort of years that are covered in this book. But was there something central? Was there some core that passed between the generations that needs a balm or has needed a balm?
Maybe, you know, maybe the balm is, some of the balm is the writing, although I didn't write the book as a balm. I mean, the book is a balm for living, but I sort of mean that in a good way. You know, it's, to me, the writing is just full of joy. I don't sort of write scrunched up in agony. You know, I have moments of being really it's really important to be stirred and to feel the feelings, but I guess that you get to conduct them as well on the page, and it's a sort of a parley that you have with them. I think there's pain and trouble passed down through the female line, and also addressed, and I don't know if addressed is the word, but I, you know, it's just interesting now to have a close proximity and relationship with my mother and see what I've inherited from her and see the likenesses too, which I grew up not really ever knowing. She talked of them, I think, because when I was a child in that time in quite a haunted house, it was literally a haunted house, my father says, on Waiheke Island, but which was the place I left from to live with my grandmothers. That was where my mother kind of started me drawing, and she was an artist, and I think that was the kind of the gift or the connection between us. And we would make egg dolls together, where she blew out eggs and I would paint and crown them, and they were always being, you know, dashed to the ground by the wind or a sleeve, or but we just actually kept making them, and the walls were covered with my drawings. So I was drawing and drawing. I've still got portraits from that time, yeah, of her and all of us in very, very intricate dresses. And I was very interested in the clothes. It was all about the clothes, you know, from four or so. So, yeah. So I guess I just want to sort of give that balance.
I understand. I understand. Yeah. It is a complex patchwork of human experience that is covered. And you are right. The book is written with humour and with a lightness. Let's come to where you at age 14, you go to live with your father then, and it's your grandmother who you know moves you on at that time. And again, one wonders how that feels. But again, so often young people just do. Something happens or a situation happens and they just do. You ring your father. He was living at the Flood House at this stage, which I think is Canvastown, right? Is the name tell us much of what we need to know? It wasn't exactly an impressive digs. Tell us a little of your arrival there and the circumstances of it.
Was kind of shot out of a cannon, really, of my grandmother's outrage and my sort of stormy, rebellious adolescence, which was looks pretty tame by contemporary standards, but it wouldn't have been if I'd had sort of access to the means. But I just wasn't, I wasn't sort of having sex or taking any drugs, but I probably wished I was fervently, and that itself was a bit of an offence. And then I just arrived at my dad's, and I think, I tried to describe a little about, the lovely oatmeal carpets and the bay windows and the view and the sort of comfort of my grandmother's. But my father's was the sort of subsiding shack that was disappearing into a floodplain every time the river rose. And he was having actually his own, I think, sort of adolescence, really. He'd just been released from marriage, his sort of second adolescence. So he was kind of in rebellion himself. And my sister had newly arrived, so we were a pretty stormy brew, all sort of nursing our own wounds and grievances and cohabiting in this crazy slum, which my father ran, actually. He was always very good at, I think, meals with a sort of organizing force, So we were well fed. I mean, I thought it was pretty horrendous, the diet. It was, soybean omelets at 6 a.m. and which was really quite disgusting to me. But I had to have, some hot protein in my stomach to catch one of three school buses. And so my father was very attentive in that way. But it was a hovel, It's kind of interesting. I've was been reading Rachel Cusk, an essay in her latest collection about sort of renovation and post-marriage, new digs and renovating. And she sort of writes about how before she renovated and there was the hideous sticky brown carpet and these just really quite ugly furnishings that no one identified, that they were sort of quite free. It was like the environment didn't bear much imprint of who they were. They hadn't sort of fashioned it to, I suppose, some sort of flattering ego image. And I do know that experience of living in my father's great messes, that there was a certain kind of freedom. I mean, you didn't have to do housework for a start, and you weren't in that kind of land of sort of renovation as some sort of weird aspirational mirror to who you might be or would like to think you are, I shared when I read that Rachel Cusk, I thought, oh, you've just named it. It gets so overlooked, the sort of strange good things that can happen in dumps.
Now, the Manorowans who would come and stay, because this was before you went to out to the Pelorus Sound yourself, they would come and stay, and this is how you began to meet them. You've said actually you don't have a word. Hippie is about as good as it gets, but you don't really have a word for what your father was, the life he was living, or how he identified, I guess. We've had beatniks and the Freaks and others, and there's also, but they're all sort of American imports. But for you, what was it of this time and these people? If there's not a word for it, what was their spirit? What was their thing?
I was reaching for that. I don't know if it's Irish actually for the gypsies. The I think they were closer to gypsies. And they even looked when I've there's a oh I'm trying to think Joseph Kudelka, Czech, I think, black and white photographer, and he actually photographed the gypsies in his part of the world. And although they've sort of got different complexions, and I could see more of a connection there than the sort of the California hippie look of, yeah, that we're maybe of cheesecloth and that we're more used to. But I also like the Irish word travellers, except of course my father and sister and I didn't do any travelling at all, which was really deeply dull. But the Manorowans did. They really were travellers, and they were quite gypsy-like. And when I first met them, I mean, they actually turned up in a horse-drawn caravan. I remember the sound of the hooves on the unsealed road, and it was an extraordinary kind of mythological, quasi-mythological event. How would you not be transported by their whole aura and just way of being? They were pretty extraordinary. They rolled up on horseback or they hitchhiked, and they just turned up because they just turned up and they crashed at our place. You know, it was a kind of a crash pad, except my dad wasn't really the crash pad sort because he didn't do drugs and he wasn't casual. There was really nothing casual about my dad. So the hippies had to adapt to that.
Were you impressed by them? Because what's very interesting is that you are very determined to continue your schooling and head to Nelson ultimately for your schooling. It was very important to you. And so there was a delay before you go to Manurewa itself. But when you were first meeting them as they were passing through, were you impressed by them? Were you attracted to their way of being? What was your opinion of them?
Well, I mean, they were hot, you know, they really were. You know, I was like 15 or 16. I couldn't believe the guys. They had sort of long hair, but they had a kind of grittiness, you know, they weren't sort of preening. There was a sort of a can-do quality. And the women had that too, of course. So there was this sort of raw kind of charisma. You talk about the observer. I think the observer just kicked in, you know, exponentially. It was almost like she'd never been given such good material, you know, and up it rocked. And I just could not believe my eyes, really. I was entranced. And I think the ethos of that world was very egalitarian. So I was never sort of spoken, I was never condescended to. It was quite respectful. I was Norman's daughter, and there was a sort of a flattering thing too, that no one kind of asked you. There was a taboo on asking. No one asked me about my schoolwork or where I was from. I was just somehow immediately, I was, you know, it was just this lovely isness or being, I don't know, I was just accepted immediately, unquestioningly, and drawn into the conversation. So it was very flattering.
There were different. I was going to say there were different iterations of how people were living and what we politely call the alternative lifestyles. There was another place that you go and visit in Motueka, and there were sort of different strands. I think this one had more of a sort of a Christian kind of ethos to it. There were sort of strands in how people organised their alternative living. Is that a fair observation?
Yes, and that was sort of the beauty of it, I think, is that you never quite knew what you were going to discover. I mean, Riverside, that you were just referring to, which was a pacifist Christian community, that was more almost of an institution. You know, it was sort of, it had, they owned their land, they farmed, they had a system, you know. I think Manurewa and quite a lot of the iterations that I moved through were more sort of anarchic, really. But yes, absolutely. There wasn't a guidebook, that's for sure. There wasn't a manual. And that was kind of, that was the point. There wasn't a manual. We'd thrown the manual away, which was really exciting. Really exciting.
They are
And sometimes...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, sometimes very dull for a 16.
Yes, well, that's going to say. They were fairly tame. And the other theme that comes through in this book and is beautifully written is an emerging young woman and emerging sexuality that happens in two ways. Your own awareness of your own sexuality and sensuality is very strong and rich, but you write also of with a sense that some of those early sexual experiences were far from perfection, shall we say. And I'm curious, and you know, this is in various situations you find yourself in living in Nelson, and as a growing woman, they were fairly tame on the free love front, weren't they? These Manurewans as well.
Yeah.
It was not one of those communities or one of those groups of people where one would feel worried about a young woman. Is that a fair observation?
Yes, I think so. I think there was actually there was a strong ethical code, and it didn't need to be discussed. It was, I think, so this, you know, I said, used the word respect before, and I think that was right. It was very respectful. Certainly wasn't an orgiastic culture. it just wasn't the vibe or the mood or the intention. It was pretty hard working, actually. I think it was probably quite a just a particularly moral collection of people, and obviously there's some chance and some, power of congruency and attraction that brought everyone together, just as in with any collection of people. So yes, it's very hard to make. I think you really raised that it's almost impossible to generalize that culture. So it's also about the microculture of all those different little niche communities and households,
What was it that took you to the Manurewa community itself and the outer reaches of the Marlborough Sounds? You'd been living in Nelson, and I think your father had gone first to Manurewa itself, and you had resisted. As I said, your education seemed very important to you, and your friendships, actually, that you built around your time there as well. But what in the end prompted you to go?
I did. So I had actually taken myself off to go flatting to do the last year of school because I was intent on pursuing my sort of early goals of university. And so I knew I had to finish school, and I didn't trust the idea of correspondence school. I just sort of didn't think the commune would be that disciplined. So I went off to school. But unfortunately, I got whooping cough bang, within sort of weeks of arrival. And I think I spent about a term in bed, a semester in bed, or on and off. And I did really decide, gosh, Miro, you need some more parenting. I just had a sense, I just wondered. I knew I had a physical illness, but I also just felt that I was out in the wide world on my own too young. I thought, I'll go to Manurewa and I'll get some parenting. I do remember thinking that, yes. Also, it seemed like it was a very alluring experience to go there, and I liked the people, so there were good reasons.
It's remote. There was a wonderful garden that one Manurewan in particular was dedicated to or had designed and built up. It had a slow rhythm and pace to it. And when you reflect on your time living there now and what the actual time immersed there, if we can put it that way, when you think of what that effect was, what is it? How formative, how fundamental is it?
I think it, gosh, I think it was really fundamental. It wasn't a goal-driven place. And so that meant there was a certain ennui, but there was also a lot of time to reflect and dream. And that was a very beautiful thing. I don't think we have so much of that in the way. We certainly don't. There was probably a bit of a lack of information. We weren't drowning in information. It was an incredible sort of observational post. I think that I was very bored and restless at my grandmother's, which in the end was sort of a nuclear household. And this just gave me this incredible taste of eclecticism, and it was a kind of valor in it all that I still rate and really admire to go out to that kind of remote corner of the world and try and create something from scratch. And I don't mean just a household, I mean a way of living and of relating. And there was very little money in that economy, and so there was an incredible richness in it. So I think it was very formative, and I do think, gosh, I'll never experience anything quite like that ever again.
Part four of the book is Modern World, and you come back to Wellington and embrace a more traditional Wellington life and onto the career that you've had. Did you ever consider yourself fundamentally one of the Manurewans, or were you a guest, a visitor?
Oh, well, they all were older than me, and unfortunately, I've suffered from imposter syndrome my whole life. So, but that's just, I always have that, no matter how deeply ingrained in a place or scene I am. So that's a tricky question. I think I was very proud to be a Manurewan, wear six skirts in winter, and I certainly embraced it. I was certainly a Manorone sartorially, you know, and I had my caravan there plonked down in the middle of the sheep paddock. And I think I felt like a Manorone, and I also felt like an imposter. Yeah. You know, I was a decade younger than everyone, or older, you know, if you think of the little children. So I was a weird in between, a weird out on my own in between. Yeah. But I was a Manorone, definitely.
I alluded to it earlier that you write that I think you were in your 40s. I'm just trying to find the words that you wrote in the book. You were in your 40s when you realised you were dealing with, talking with a psychologist friend, I think. You realised, or you told her, that you always just disappear into something or to someone else. I'm curious to hear you refer to the imposter syndrome, which is a very common syndrome, but... But what was that realization for you in your 40s, and how does it manifest, and how do you manage it in what is clearly a very busy and productive, engaged and successful career in life? What were you alluding to by that?
I think it's a certain kind of porousness. I think that's probably the word I use in the book. And Doris, my friend, who was this sort of uber achiever, really, and sort of someone quite luminous with understanding, she could verbalise. So I was really quite gratified and redeemed to find that this person, who seemed so much more integrated and extroverted than me, also said she was way up one end of the spectrum where maybe I was, in terms of just sort of absorbing. You know, it sounds a bit sort of boastful to say you absorb other people. I don't know. There's just sort of impressions and feelings, and you've got to go away and process them. And writing is a lot of that processing. So I some of it's empathy, some of it's just some kind of receptivity that I think when I was a young woman I found really difficult to negotiate. I mean, I had a lot of trouble with boundaries. I just didn't really have any. I still sort of have to deal with that, and I have to go for lots of long walks to kind of rebuild myself sometimes after a very, after being around a lot of, even with my teaching, I sort of have to have that balance. But I think it's a good thing. It's probably just a job description of a writer, maybe a filmmaker, you know, that because you need that to enter a sense of other people, person by, you know, encounter by encounter. I don't want to sort of make any grand claims here. I think it's sort of, it's temperamental, and it gives you a kind of an identity instability, really. I feel like I often disappear as in not having a sense of who the hell I am, even at, you know, 56. I don't think I'm alone in that. Yeah.
I'm just you've stressed the obvious creative talents of your parents in writing and in the arts, and I'm thinking in some ways in the formation of a writer and the formation of an artist and the formation of a filmmaker, those early life experiences, not just the gifts, the obvious gifts that are handed, but the early life experiences that one has to navigate can also provide the building blocks of, you know, of feeling very deeply, of observing very deeply, of questioning, and of not just falling into a very safe, predictable life. It can have downsides and traumatic impacts on people, of course, but there can also be a yielding of a different kind of gift. I am, if you would indulge us, I'm very curious of the closeness that you develop with your mother, because in the book, I think there's a reference to you seeing her in your teens when you were living in Nelson and then not again for many years. So has this been an evolution, and if not a reconciliation, just a getting to know each other that has happened over the years?
Yes, it has. It has, and it didn't happen till quite late, you know, till I guess I was in my late 40s, early 50s. But it is. It's sort of simply that, because, you know, the thing about my mother is she's largely off screen in the book, and that's And that's not a device. That's just a simple fact. You know, she wasn't there. We weren't close. Just we didn't have any proximity even. And she was sort of in some ways unknowable to me, although, of course, I was her child. I came out of her body. There was always that bond and that knowing that brings. And I suppose as I'm older, I see now all the likenesses as well. Perhaps the fact that we drew together when I was so young for so many hours was a kind of expression of that amidst all the difficulty and unhappiness, and the fact that she just wasn't really a mother at that point in her life, you know, and unfortunately I was around. But, yeah, there's been I think she calls it, you know, just an unexpected flowering. Which is, I'm told, pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I sort of, yeah, in a way I try not to talk about it because I just want to experience it and not make any claims for it. Just sort of, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's my taste of normalcy. I don't know.
Mira, thank you. Thank you. You want to enjoy it, I imagine, as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Mira Bilbray, In the Time of the Manorowans, is the book published by Victoria University Press.